You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, June 27th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, best-selling author of What's the Matter with Kansas, author of Pity the Billionaire, publisher of The Baffler, writer at Harper's Magazine, on, I guess, Why You Can't Go Home, Thomas Frank. Also on the program today, we get a report from Ted Alexandro, who is part of Occupy Long Island City. They're doing a day of listening and learning at the Citibank building in Astoria, New York. All this on the eve of the big announcement from the Supreme Court tomorrow. Some people are saying that we're spending too much time on it. I think this is going to be a pretty big deal, frankly. And again, I think people are well aware of my sense of the Supreme Court being so important in terms of voting. That's always been my ballywick, as it were. For years now, I have lamented just how little it seems people on the left really focus on the Supreme Court. And of course, longtime listeners of this program will know that My following of the 2000 selection for presidency, I don't think it's fair to say borderlined on obsessive. I think obsessive is probably more accurate. But as we look to this ruling from the Supreme Court tomorrow on health care, Tyler Cowen, who is a right-wing libertarian-like economist from George Mason University. He writes at a blog called A Marginal Revolution, and I saw this graph from, not graph, but this paragraph via Balloon Juice, which is a great blog, of course, read nearly daily. And Tyler Cowen is talking about the principles that libertarian and conservatives should have when it comes to regarding healthcare. And he lays out the three or four here. But the one that is, I think, most telling. Remember, the Affordable Care Act, at least as it was set out, was to provide universal healthcare, which means healthcare for all Americans. It doesn't mean single payer. It doesn't mean it doesn't mean Medicare for all. It just means that everyone is covered. We are the only industrialized nation in the world that doesn't have some form of universal healthcare. And the Affordable Care Act will not achieve universality. It will come somewhat close. It's going to expand healthcare coverage for 13 million people off the bat. They're going to have healthcare. And the mandate, which, you know, we've spoken about this in the past, but it's getting a little more attention, which is really, in essence, no genuine mandate in and of itself. There's no enforcement mechanism. We talked about that yesterday in the replay of that interview with Amanda Frost we did several months ago. But there really is no enforcement mechanism. There's a penalty that's imposed, but there's no real way to collect on that penalty. But be that as it may, this is very telling. And we heard Ron Paul when he got up there and he was talking about, well, you don't have health insurance, you don't have health insurance. I want to read this paragraph from Tyler Cowen because it's nice to see them being honest about it. But the real question is, do the American people, is this how the American people perceive what America is about? When we talk about American exceptionalism, is this what we're talking about? His number two principle that the right should embrace on healthcare is, quote, a rejection of healthcare egalitarianism, namely a recognition that the wealthy will purchase more and better healthcare than the poor. Trying to equalize healthcare consumption hurts the poor, since most feasible policies to do this take away cash from the poor, either directly or through the operation of tax incidents. Now, this is, I think, a fairly specious argument, but he's also equating, like, you lose a couple of dollars in cash, theoretically, because it comes out of the economy because of taxes, theoretically, but you get health care. But that's still, it hurts the poor. But then he says, we need to accept the principle that sometimes poor people will just die. Excuse me. We need to accept the principle that sometimes poor people will die just because they are poor. Some of you don't like the sound of that, but we already let the wealthy enjoy all sorts of other goods, most importantly status, which lengthens their lives, which the poor enjoy to a much lesser degree. We shouldn't screw up our healthcare institutions by being determined to fight inegalitarian principles for one very select set of factors which determine healthcare outcomes. What he's saying here is that it is better to have a healthcare system that will attract Saudi princes on occasion than one that improves the health and extends the lives of as many people as possible. Rich people already live longer because they live better lives. Let's not focus on the idea of providing the poor healthcare at the expense of anything else. And it's not just that there may be some other things that we like better. So, marginally speaking, you know, we drive our cars and people die. A lot of people die in their cars, but we're not going to give up our cars. No, we have to embrace, accept the principle that sometimes poor people will die just because they are poor. That's the way to a better America. Unbelievable.
I mean, obviously, something like that is always going to happen, but doesn't mean you don't do anything about it.
No, it's not just a question of you don't do anything about it. You proactively embrace the fact that it happens. It's not we can't do anything about it. It's that specifically, this is the way it should be. Effing believable, but that's what they believe, and you got to give them credit for being honest about it. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Tom Frank. are back on the Majority Report. I'm Sam Seder on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the author of the best-selling What's the Matter with Kansas, author of Pity the Billionaire, writer at Harper's Magazine. Are you the publisher or the editor of The Baffler?
Well, I'm not either anymore, but I used to be the editor, and I started it way back in the day.
The founder of The Baffler, which is back with us, Thomas Frank. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Well, it's my pleasure as always, Sam.
So I take it from your latest Harper's piece, you just can't go back home, can you?
Well, there's something really depressing about it, you know. I don't know if your listeners have been following what's going on in Kansas, but like many states, it was really swept by the Tea Party tidal wave in 2010. And I mean, it was already a conservative state, you know, already a firmly Republican state, always has been. But the sort of conservative wave just swamped the place. The U.S. Senator Sam Brownback is now the governor. So I guess he's a former U.S. senator now. The Republicans basically they won every statewide office. They totally they beat every Democrat in the state in the congressional delegation. There's now no Democrats from Kansas. There used to always be one or two, you know. They're all gone. When I was there, I was talking to Democrats in the state Senate. You know how many of them there are left? 8.
How many out of how many total?
Out of 40.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So this is what one would call now a pretty red state.
Yeah, it's always been a Republican state, but it for years they had this war between the two factions of the Republican Party, the conservatives and the moderates, that went on and on and on there, and that was sort of one of the themes of What's the Matter with Kansas was this war between these two factions, and you think of a guy like Bob Dole, who is a sort of classic mm-hmm. Kansas figure. Who was regarded as conservative when he, you know, a long time ago when he first started getting elected in the 60s and 70s and when he ran for president. And, well, by the time he ran for president in 96, he wasn't all that far to the right anymore because the politics of the country had really gone past him. And today he would be way too liberal for Kansas. Or the other U.S. senator when I was growing up was Nancy Kassebaum, who was, I guess today you'd say, a liberal Republican. I mean, there's no other.
I mean, we're getting – the Affordable Care Act is not totally Bob Dole's, but he was one of the big champions of this.
Yeah, that's right. And that whole faction has just been wiped out in Kansas. So the conservatives have managed to basically take everything – with the exception of the state Senate, where there's still enough moderate Republicans there to stop some of the zanier things, but they don't stop everything. And so Governor Brownback and his team have basically, you know, spit on their hands and gone in there and tried to enact the whole sort of Tea Party agenda
now,
all at once, and they've had a lot of success.
What really surprised me is that my assumption. When I hear, you know, when I contemplate the idea of Sam Brownback being the governor of Kansas, is that it is what you're going to see is an agenda that is, you know, not quite the Taliban, but I would have perceived his agenda to be very much about social conservatism.
Right, right, of course, because that's what he's known for in the Senate.
That's what I associated with him. And,
yeah.
And yet, he has really essentially from the perspective of a conservative or someone from the hard right, he has really enacted a conservative sort of economic. I mean, this has been his charge.
Let's talk about one thing in particular, which is the package of tax cuts that they just passed. And we think, oh, Republicans, they passed tax cuts. That's right. This package of tax cuts is really remarkable. It basically does away with the state income tax in Kansas for middle class and for upper middle class people and rich people. They no longer have to pay anything because they've made all these ways of they've come up with all these ways of where you can get your state income tax down to zero if you set up certain legal, you know, entities, if you run your income through certain kinds of legal entities, your income tax goes to zero. The only people that are still going to, if you're a small businessman, you don't have to pay any income tax. And there's no definition of small business, so every business can be categorized as a small business. If you're a farmer, you don't have to pay any income tax. Now, so the only people who are going to be left paying income tax in Kansas is people who work for, you know, people who work for a living.
And frankly, the rest of us, because they get more money from the federal government than they put in, and so basically we're subsidizing their tax cuts.
Well, okay, yes, but they've cut the taxes so dramatically, and they're going to – I mean, it's going to destroy the revenue to the state. And you know what? A state like Kansas, what the state government basically does, I mean, it doesn't do a lot. It's not a, you know, it's not a some kind of welfare state sort of place. The state government basically does education, and that's it. And, you know, they run the highways, that sort of thing. And this is going to destroy the schools in that state. And you might think these are the people that are against evolution, the theory of evolution anyways. Okay, fair enough. But when I was growing up there, Kansas had excellent public schools. It was some of the best in America. I mean, the one I went to routinely churned out all these, you know, national merit scholars and all. I was one of them. I mean, that's the kind of place that it was. Kansas always had very good schools, and that seems to be – the day for that is over. That's the most consequential thing that they've done, but they've done, you know, 100 other lesser things to really throw, you know, everything in reverse. For example, they abolished the state arts agency, which is the only state in America to do that.
Yeah, you tell the story. I mean, it's the story of the murals and the guy who wrote the murals, because that is
well the murals, if you ever happen to go to Topeka, if you're ever driving through on Highway 70 or something like that, you should stop the car and go to the State House, to the Kansas Capitol Building, because there's these very famous murals on the wall. And like other State House murals, they were painted in the 1930s, which was a sort of great era for, you know, public mural art, you know. And they were painted by a guy called John Stuart Curry, who was a famous regionalist painter, which was the style in the 1930s. One of the paintings is very well known. It's of John Brown, you know, the abolitionist, mm-hmm. who was from Kansas and who basically got the Civil War going in Kansas about 10 years before it went national, you know, and it's a terrifying picture of John Brown. He's painted it like four times life size. His hands are dripping with blood. He's got a Bible in one hand and a rifle in the other, you know, that sort of thing. But the painter, John Stuart Curry, also painted these kind of pastoral scenes of Kansas farmers, you know, because that's what Kansas is. It's, right. It's a farm state. And it shows he painted these pictures of prosperous farmers, and when he was it's kind of a long and not so funny story, but basically before he could finish painting his murals, the state government got angry at him and fired him. You know, wouldn't let him finish because they thought he was some kind of crazy liberal. Which, you know, I guess he was by the standards of today. So here's the thing. So I'm out there in Kansas and I'm reading in the Topeka newspaper, and Governor Brownback writes an editorial for the Topeka paper talking about his vision of our ideal Kansas. And he's looking at this John Stuart Curry mural of Kansas farmers, you know, prosperous Kansas farmers, and thinking, yeah, that's what it's all about. Every man for himself out in the high plains, you know, that's the Kansas way. And it's so ironic in so many ways. First of all, because of, you know, that the state legislature at the time that Curry was making those murals fired Curry because they thought he was, you know, politically, they thought he was too radical. And second of all, because that isn't the Kansas way. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but in Washington, they're forever debating something called the Farm Bill, where they hand out money, you know, in great numbers to farmers on the high plains. Farming is an industry that it's not every man for himself. It has never been that way from the days of the Homestead Act and the land grant university right down to the present. The idea that that's what Kansas is all about, you know, these small towns out there are just people making their way in the world with nothing but two strong arms, you know, is ridiculous. It's a subsidized way of life. You know, it's a way of life that depends on community, you know, both at the state level and at the national level, that depends on that to keep going. And yet, Sam Brownback sort of takes this Ayn Rand lesson. And by the way, you know, this is another ironic thing. Sam Brownback is, I don't know if you're aware of this, he's extremely religious. When he was in the U.S. Senate, he was famous for being one of the most sort of publicly religious members of that body. You know, there's an incident where he was washing the feet of one of his employees, one of his assistants. You know, he lived in that
right.
that group house on Capitol Hill.
Right, the C house or whatever.
Yeah, the house on C Street or whatever it was. All that sort of thing. And the you know, that a man like that would sort of regard this philosophy of every man for himself as you know.
And the painting,
way of,
and the painting itself was probably commissioned with federal money, right? I mean, there's probably
I don't know if there was federal money involved, but there's obviously state money involved because it's in the state capitol building. But John Stuart Curry, the man who painted it, did paint federal buildings all the time. He painted a very famous mural in the Department of Agriculture building here in Washington, D.C. He was, you know, he lived in Wisconsin, and that's what he did for a living, is he painted these murals on public buildings. In the 1930s, I mean, he was one of the star painters of that period. All these other painters tried to mimic his style. They called it regionalism. And if you, when you're driving on I-70 across Kansas, stop your car in some small town and go into the post office, and as likely as not, you'll see a mural on the wall that's a knockoff of John Stuart Curry, put there by the WPA. That's what they did. That was their house style. Was what this guy, you know, was imitating this guy. And you know, that's something that I associate with the Midwest and with the 1930s and with the WPA. I mean, everybody that studied that period and that style does. And yet Sam Brownback regards it as a kind of manifesto of individualism. It's just strange how these symbols get twisted over the years, you know.
But isn't that, I mean, that seems to me to sort of be the sort of the perfect metaphor. I mean, when you see Brownback come in and institute all of these where, you know, it's almost come full circle, you know, the idea that social issues get people to vote.
They get you out there to vote, yeah.
They get you out there to vote in many instances against your economic interests for people who have pretty dire economic circumstances. But now it seems like there's been a buy-in to those policies that were in some ways sort of like we feed you the social issues with the right hand and we slide in these other economic issues that you're not terribly. But now it seems like the meal is these sort of economic programs that are directly aimed against these people. I mean that
they're going to crush working people in that state. That is who bears the tax burden. By the way, Kansas has one very rich person living in one of the Koch brothers in Wichita. And somebody, one of my, I forget where I read it, somebody did the math. He's going to be able to, probably going to be able to avoid paying state income tax because of this new tax law. And guys like him all over the state are not going to pay any tax. But working people in Kansas will assume the entire burden. I mean, that's unbelievable, and those are the people that furnish the votes. I mean, Charles Koch has one vote.
But aren't they now? Isn't there a certain amount? I mean, it seems like sweeping across country, and I think part of this you know, is a function of not just that the Democrats have left a vacuum at this point, but when President Obama spends half of his administration talking about the government must tighten its belt, like families must tighten their belt, and when the establishment of the Democratic Party is embracing austerity at a time like this.
Well, there's no, you know, you shouldn't even get me started on this. I'm so angry at Obama, and I'm so depressed about what's happened with the Democratic Party. Not that I'm, you know, my fortune is tied to the Democratic Party or anything like that, but you know, to see liberalism get beaten at what ought to be its moment of greatest triumph, you know, it's absolutely maddening. And Sam Brownback mistaking that piece of art, which is basically in the social realist style, for a individualist manifesto, is a perfect example of this. We've taken what ought to be the moment of when we realize how, you know, what a good idea social insurance was, what a good idea the New Deal was, how, you know, the liberals of you know, our grandparents' generation really did have things right, and instead we decided to cut taxes on the very richest people in society and make everybody else, you know, suffer. That's how we've decided to respond to this crisis. It's just like Sam Brownback mistaking that painting, you know, getting it completely reading it completely 180 degrees wrong. That's us, man.
And was, I mean, so let me ask you this: if you had to deal with what's the matter with Kansas again? I mean, if you sat down to write that book today, and you know, in some ways, I mean, you've revisited Kansas here in this piece. Would the dynamic be the same? I mean, in other words, the idea that there's a missed opportunity here, as opposed to this is not just simply a case of misfeasance. There's a certain amount of malfeasance.
No, this is done deliberately. These people they're not stupid. You know, one of the people that I interview in the book is Chris Kobach, who your listeners might know as the author of the Arizona Immigration Act, which the Supreme Court just dealt with the other day. And he's from Kansas. Not only is he from Kansas, he was he's my age. Went to high school at the same time. We were both in high school debate. I debated him. He went to one of the Topeka high schools. I went to one of the ones in Johnson County, which is Kansas City. And I interviewed him, and I was reminded of how intelligent he is. And he's not some kind of, you know, everybody thinks he must be some sort of, you know, knuckle dragging monster, and he's not at all. He's a very sophisticated, very clever, well-spoken guy. You know, these guys are smart. They are playing the game very, very well. It's not these things haven't happened, you know, just by chance. They've happened because one side has played the political game extremely well, and the other side is out there. I mean, just blundering.
But that's,
blundering.
I mean, but that's what I'm saying. Is it? Are we seeing blundering, or are we simply seeing a sort of a two front a war here? I mean,
I
don't want to get you even more depressed.
Sam, you and I, we all know what is missing from the conversation in this country. We all know that this is happening because there's only one choice out there. This is my book that came out this year, Pity the Billionaire, is all about this crazy dynamic. It's gone much further than what's the matter with Kansas. You know, that was 8 years ago. You know, when I wrote that, I remember people saying, "Oh, well, you know, we'll have a really bad economic downturn, and people will come back to the paths of economic righteousness then." And you know, it's like, well, that happened. We had the downturn. And everything got worse.
Right.
Everything got worse. And we all know – I mean, the argument that I make in Pity the Billionaire – I shouldn't say we all know it because we don't. The argument that I make is that this happens and this keeps going like this because one side of the debate is completely missing from a place like Kansas, and pretty much from the nation in general. And that's the side of the debate that used to be sort of carried by organized labor, farmers' unions, organizations like that, that spoke from the bottom up and that talked about social insurance and economic justice and all that sort of thing. And for our grandparents' generation, that was sort of common wisdom. That was stuff that everybody understood, you know, that everybody got. You know, you could make a critique of Wall Street and everybody got it. Today you make a critique of Wall Street and everybody thinks that what you're calling for is to end the Fed, you know, or to put us back on the gold standard or something crazy like that. And it's like the right just owns that argument. And so what's happened? You go to a city like Wichita, Kansas, and Wichita is to this day a manufacturing town. They build airplanes there. And used to be a heavily unionized town. Used to be a town with some serious class consciousness to it. Today, and if you were to ask about, you know, the economic catastrophes of our time, you'd get different answers from different people. The unions would be out there telling you it's one thing, and the Chamber of Commerce would be out there telling you it's something else. Okay, well, you take away one half of that debate, you know, and you've only got one answer that's available to people. The only sort of economic dissent. The only voice of dissent that you hear in a place like that is Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck. You know, and Glenn Beck, by the way, another guy is sort of famous for, or I tried to make him famous for, mistaking 1930s sort of artifacts of the 1930s as artifacts of individualism. The same thing that Brownback did that we've been talking about here. And this is all the consequences of there just being one side to this debate, okay? And you and I mean, I know we try, Sam. We try. I write books. You have a radio show. You write books too. It's just so massively frustrating.
Well, I had a feeling we would get to this place in our conversation.
I know, it's the end of the world. You look out there. It's the end of the world. The rich people in Kansas have just successfully dodged their entire tax burden, income tax burden, and put it on the shoulders of their employees. Can you believe that?
They've
done it while like talking, like pointing to a work of social realist art. It boggles the mind, sir.
It does, and I guess the only hope is that by continuing to offer another answer, maybe when we're faced with another opportunity, that answer will be picked up. I guess we're going to have to wait and see.
I mean, all right. You're right. Whatever. All right. I'm just a ray of sunshine, Sam. I'm sorry. I'm in a terrible mood. I'm, you know, thinking about the Obama, the 4 years of Obama now, you know, and I'm really disheartened about the whole thing.
I understand. Believe me. Well, maybe let me see if I can help with this.
High on a hill was a lonely goat. Her lay.
Can you hear that?
No, what is it?
Oh, we'll try. Hold on for 1 second. We got it? Can you hear that?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. That was. I just played that that song from The Sound of Music, where the kids are jumping through the meadows. That's in moments like this. That's apropos.
Yeah. That's, my daughter loves that song.
Well, Thomas, the piece is great, and it's a fascinating look. And we will talk to you soon, and hopefully, who knows? Hope springs eternal.
Speak for yourself, sir.
I'll try. All right. Thomas Frank, everybody, we got to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment with Ted Alexandro, who is down at a Citibank protest right now. So, Thomas, hopefully, at the very least, we know there's some people out there getting the message out there.
All right. That's good.
All right. Talk to you soon. We got to take a break, folks. We'll be back in just a moment. And if you're calling us at 646-257-3920, hang on. We'll get to your calls momentarily.
We're all presidents, we're all congressmen, we're all cops and waiters. And it's only about survival. much motion out of this as possible. Let's try not to remember any names. We'll do it for a country, for a people, for more vision. Not it will make them remember our history.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Ted Alexandro. He is with Occupy Astoria LIC, or is it Occupy LIC?
It's Occupy Astoria LIC.
Okay, and that, of course, Astoria, Queens, Long Island City in New York. Yeah. And so, Ted, what are you doing on this nice sunny Wednesday?
It's a beautiful day, Sam, and we are out in front of the Citibank building in Long Island City. There's a group of us demonstrating and protesting the big banks, and specifically Citibank. This is kind of, for us, an outgrowth of what started at Zuccotti Park and now has gone to the local grassroots level, where one of many kind of local Occupy groups. So this is an event that we had planned.
And how many folks do you have out there? Do you have a decent amount of people?
Yeah, it's kind of, ebb and flow throughout the day. Started small with probably like 15 or 20. We planned the day from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Now at lunchtime, it's probably up to about 50 or 60 now that lunchtime is starting, and we're expecting it to kind of swell into the hundreds as lunchtime progresses, and then also later this afternoon when folks get out of work.
So give me.
But our plan was to just be here all day, and then people can come when they can come.
And give me a sense of what you're doing. I mean, you know, one of the things that I think Occupy has been very good at and continues to do on sort of like, you know, this type of somewhat relative to the mainstream media anyways, under the you guys are also selling ice cream too. Well done.
It's all happening, is
to basically just educate people people just give people a sense that, you know, just to broaden the message. So give me a sense of what you guys are doing down there and how the people that are sort of walking into this situation are reacting.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You always have a range of reactions, but I would say the majority have been very positive. You know, we have a sign out by the road, honk if you pay taxes, city does not. And, you know, a lot of passersby and motorists honking horns in support. A lot of people on their way to work in the morning, very supportive, saying, I'm with you guys. I'm sorry I have to work. I wish I could be here all day, that kind of thing. People that are coming back after work. But the real reason is kind of what you alluded to, of just furthering that conversation, you know, that necessary conversation that gets squashed by kind of corporate media, that, you know, this oligarchy has really kind of created a situation in which they're squashing the middle class, they're squashing the poor, the wealth is really being funneled in one direction, and it's not fair, and it's not healthy, it's not democracy, and it's not capitalism either. It's really a perversion of capitalism. So that's why, you know, we're out here to further that conversation.
You know, it's apropos. I just got off the phone with Thomas Frank, who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas? And he had just, wrote a piece in Harper's about visiting Kansas and seeing the effects of the lack of another narrative about how things can be or should be. And that's why I think what you guys are doing is so important. I mean, you're, and obviously, if you had the capacity to spend $4 million on a national advertisement, although there are some, I know that Occupy the Homes is putting up some PSAs, but that conversation would be hitting more people. But it's got to take local Occupy groups like yourselves, who are spreading this word, on a person-to-person basis.
Absolutely. You know, I think, Sam, that it's a less sexy story than Zuccotti Park was, where people were sleeping out in a park and camping out and clashes with the police and all those kind of side stories that, in fact, were not the story. You know, the reason behind people sleeping out there for months is really the story. All of these, you know, all of the fraud, the corporate fraud that continues to go on, the bailouts, the continuing bailouts, in fact, the fact that, that they get slapped with these fines that are a fraction of what they wind up making anyway,
right,
with no admission of wrongdoing, you know. So these are the conversations that I think it's just so important to continue to have. And it's also, it's always invigorating to be around like-minded folks who are also furthering that message.
All right. Well, great stuff, Ted. We're going to put a link. We obviously have a link on majority.fm to OccupyAstoriaLIC.org. And head down there. The big city. It's the big city, big Citibank building in Astoria, correct?
That's right. It's the huge Citibank building. You can't miss it if you look across to Queens from Manhattan. It's that huge tower right in Long Island City.
All right. Well, hopefully folks will head out there. You guys are going to be there till 8 p.m. Really appreciate the work you're doing, Ted, and keep us updated.
Thanks, Sam. And people can take the E, G, or M as in Mary, or 7 train right to Court Square Station, and that'll let you out right here. And apparently there's ice cream, so come and get it.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks so much, Ted. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Take care.
All right. All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program now. We've got callers already on the line. We will get to you in just one moment. First thing I do in the better half of the program, folks, again, need your membership to keep even the first 40 minutes going. Never mind the second half of the show. Just the first 40 minutes is dependent on your direct support of this program. You can become a member at majority.fm. You will continue to fund getting stories out there that you won't hear anywhere else. I've already gotten great feedback on the interview we did with Lori Wallach yesterday on this Trans-Pacific Partnership. And, you know, you already start to see the messaging going out. Obviously, this is not from our program yesterday, but somebody emailed me, told me that they got an email from I think it was the AFL alerting people to this trade program. And this is one of those instances where, you know, like Lori Wallach said, sunlight is the best disinfectant for these type of things. Make it politically untenable. And the, you know, we do at this program try and cast just a little ray of sunlight, if not always sunshine. So your support very much needed. You can also support the show by giving us a good review on iTunes, buying some merch, going to justcoffee.coop, getting some great coffee with a 10% discount, coupon code majority, buying crap through our Amazon link. If you buy crap through Amazon, do it at majority.fm. Support the show. You'll see the Amazon link. Just click it, bookmark it, buy all your crap through there. Number 646-257-3920. See you in the better half.
Hey,